Good morning, you are listening to Radio Maria, and this is Father Toby with the Friar Side. And on Wednesdays on the Friar Side, I'm going to either be sort of talking just about sort of topics that interest me, that concern me at the moment, or having some people on to interview. And then on Mondays and Tuesdays, we'll be sort of dealing with the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, or no, dealing's not a great word for that, sort of engaging with the thought and seeing the perennial relevance of his deep insights on theology and teaching, and also the perennial relevance of the method by which he did theology. But being Wednesday, I'm going to do something a little bit different today. I don't have anybody in the studio with me, but I have a topic that's important to me and which I want to discuss a bit. But I'm not going to say what that topic is, so that this first example hopefully has a little more impact and catches people a little bit more by surprise. It's from a book, not by me. I'll tell you the title of the book afterwards and why I think it matters so much. But here's the example that the author asks us to think about. Suppose that when your first child turned 10, a visionary billionaire whom you've never met chose her to join the first permanent human settlement on Mars. Her academic performance plus an analysis of her genome, which you don't remember giving consent for, clinched her a spot. Unbeknownst to you, she had signed herself up for the mission because she loves outer space. And besides, all of her friends have signed up. She begs you to let her go. Before saying no, you agree to learn more. You learn that the reason they're recruiting children is that they adapt better to the unusual conditions of Mars than adults, particularly the low gravity. If children go through puberty and its associated growth spurt on Mars, their bodies will be permanently tailored to it, unlike settlers who come over as adults. At least that's the theory. It is unknown whether Mars-adapted children would be able to return to Earth. You find other reasons for fear. First, there's the radiation. Earth's flora and fauna evolved under the protective shield of the magnetosphere, which blocks or diverts most of the solar wind, cosmic rays, and other streams of harmful particles that bombard our planet. Mars doesn't have such a shield, so a far greater number of ions would shoot through the DNA of each cell in your daughter's body. The project's planners have built protective shields for the Mars settlement based on studies of adult astronauts who have a slightly elevated risk of cancer after spending a year in space. But children are at an even higher risk because their cells are developing and diversifying more rapidly and would experience higher rates of cellular damage. Did the planners take this into account? Did they do any research on child safety at all? As far as you can tell, no. And then there's gravity. Evolution optimized the structure of every creature over eons for the gravitational force on our particular planet. From birth onward, each creature's bones, joints, muscles, and cardiovascular system develop in response to the unchanging one-way pull of gravity. Removing this constant pull profoundly affects our bodies. The muscles of adult astronauts who spend months in the weightlessness of space become weaker, and their bones become less dense. Their body fluids collect in places where they shouldn't, such as the brain cavity, which puts pressure on the eyeballs and changes their shape. Mars has gravity, but it's only 38% of what a child would experience on Earth. Children raised in the low-gravity environment of Mars would be at high risk of developing deformities in their skeletons, hearts, eyes, and brains. Did the planners take this vulnerability of children into account? As far as you can tell, no. So would you let her go? Would you let your daughter go on this trip to Mars? Well, of course not. You realize this is a completely insane idea, sending children to Mars, perhaps never to return to Earth. Why would any parent allow it? Now, the company behind the project is racing to stake its claim to Mars before any rival company. Its leaders don't seem to know anything about child development and don't seem to care about children's safety. Worse still, the company did not require proof of parental permission. As long as a child checks a box stating she has obtained parental permission, she can blast off to Mars. No company could ever take our children away and endanger them without our consent, though, or they would face massive liabilities, right? Well, this is the setup that the author Jonathan Haidt uses in his book, The Anxious Generation. And as I've read this again, I realize even more how clever the setup is. And now let's bring that hypothetical of Mars into our present reality. And so Haidt says, at the turn of the millennium, technology companies based on the west coast of the United States created a set of world-changing products that took advantage of the rapidly growing internet. There was a widely shared sense of techno-optimism. These products made life easier, more fun, and more productive. Some of them helped to connect and communicate, and therefore it seemed likely they would be a boon to the growing number of emerging democracies. Coming soon after the fall of the Iron Age, of the Iron Curtain, it felt like the dawn of a new age. The founders of these companies were hailed as heroes, geniuses, and global benefactors who, like Prometheus, brought gifts from the gods to humanity. But the tech industry wasn't just transforming life for adults. It began transforming life for children too. Children and adolescents had been watching a lot of television since the 1950s. But the new technologies were far more portable, personalized, and engaging than anything that came before. Parents discovered this truth early, as Haidt said he did in 2008, when his two-year-old son mastered the touch and swipe interface of the first iPhone. Marrying parents found themselves relieved that a smartphone or tablet could keep a child happily engaged and quiet for hours. But was this safe? Well, nobody knew because everyone else was doing it. And because everyone else was doing it, they just assumed that it must be okay. Yet, as Haidt points out, and as we're discovering, tech companies had done little or no research on the mental health effects of their products on children and adolescents, and they shared no data with researchers studying the health effects. And when these companies were faced with growing evidence that their products were harming young people, they mostly engaged in denial, obfuscation, and public relations campaign. And it's the companies that strive to maximize engagement by using psychological tricks to keep young people clicking that were the worst offenders. They hooked children during vulnerable developmental stages, while their brains were rapidly rewiring in response to incoming stimulation. This included social media companies, which inflicted their greatest damage on girls, and video companies and pornography sites, which sank their hooks deepest into boys. By designing a fire hose of addictive content that entered through kids' eyes and ears, and by displacing physical play and in-person socializing, these companies have rewired childhood and changed human development on an almost unimaginable scale. So that's the setup, and I think we are in a situation whereby we've sent our children to Mars with really no idea what will happen to them and what the effects of time on Mars will be. And how all this time on Mars will equip them for the reality of the world in which they will have to enter. This thought of Jonathan Haidt and the unregulation of the technological world that our children are now completely immersed in was a point made much earlier by Neil Postman, who was a wonderful philosopher of media, and he referred to our type of culture as a technopoly. In fact, he has a book by the same name. Perhaps his most famous and best book to read first is called Amusing Ourselves to Death. But he, in calling our culture a technopoly, which he contrasts with tool-using cultures where the use of technology is limited and strictly utilitarian and tradition holds sway, says in our technopoly, the use of technology as an end in and of itself begins to take hold, and belief in progress comes to dominate the culture. And in a technopoly, the technology has gained a monopoly over the culture, and efficiency actually becomes the only value universally held, and no institutions remain unaffected by the technological imperative. And this is, I think we see in our present age, whereby as long as something is sort of efficient and enables us to do something quicker, nobody sort of questions whether this is a good thing. And yet huge changes are being wrought on our society, and nobody's really asking what are the effects of this, and what are these technologies for. And as Postman, as Marshall McLuhan, and others realized a few decades ago, that first of all we shape the tools, but then over time the tools start to shape us. This is even more the case with these powerful computer technologies, and especially with the smartphones, which most of us carry around in our pockets now. And what Jonathan Haidt studies, and what also that of a lady called Jean Twenge, who I'm going to tell you a little bit about, and her research shortly, what Haidt and Twenge have come to realize is that profound generational differences have been manifested now, and Twenge sees that technology as being the driver behind so many of these. Let's listen to a little bit of music, and then we'll hear a little bit from Jean Twenge and her book Generations, on actually what drives the changes between generations, and her new theory of what drives this. Listening to Radio Maria, and this is Father Toby with the Friar Side, and we're thinking today about the impact of technology, about Neil Postman's idea of our culture as a sort of a technopoly, which has a mindset which says that technology should be sort of entirely unrelated, and the only thing which determines whether a technology is good or not is whether it's efficient, with little reflection actually of the effect that the technology has on us. And I was saying before the break that I wanted to introduce you a little bit to the thought of Jean Twenge, or her surname might in fact be pronounced Twenge, I'm not sure, it's Twenge. And Jean, I'm going to carry on calling it a Twenge, although, as I said, could be Twenge. She has been one of the leading researchers on generational differences. Now, to some people, this is a sort of a controversial field, and they dispute the idea that there are that we can speak sort of accurately of different generations. I understand some of the reluctance behind sort of speaking about generations, and we have to be careful that we don't say because somebody belongs to this generation, therefore they behave like this. We must avoid narrow stereotypes. But nonetheless, I think there are some helpful generalizations that we can draw by looking at the traits which these different generations seem to display. And I think it's very, very important for us if we're going to evangelize people that we know something about them. And knowing something about them is, I think, includes not only the particular circumstances of their lives, but the culture in which they grew up. And as Jonathan Haidt was seeking to bring out in his sort of hypothetical about sending a child to Mars, he was saying that the effect of childhood on Mars would be very much greater on the sort of on the developing child than it would be on an adult going to Mars for an equivalent period of time who had already fully developed. And what Twenge and Haidt both are observing is that our technologies and the really rapid development of technology are causing quite different cultures for our children to grow up in, and these are resulting in quite stark generational differences. Now, Twenge was one of the first people to suggest that actually what influenced generational difference most profoundly was technology and the way that it changed culture, as opposed to world events. Most previous sociologists studying generational difference were concerned with what were the major historical events that had occurred during the childhood of this particular generation. But as Twenge points out, these seem to have a sort of a cyclical dimension to them, that the war might be different that's going on, but the reality is, for so much of human history, most children have grown up with one war going on or something. Most children have that also we see that sort of, you know, boom and bust isn't isolated to sort of just one generation. There are numerous generations who've grown up in times of recession, and there are numerous generations who've grown up in times of great economics sort of expansion and abundance. And she says, given that these things are cyclical, we would then, if it were the major global events that affected generational traits most, we wouldn't expect to see a kind of a linear direction of travel for the generations, by which means you can see a continuing pattern of changing developments becoming more stark from one generation to the next. Whereas if it were historical events that were occurring things, you would expect that the generations that grew up, say, in a period of economic boom would have more in common with one another than generations that grew up in a period of economic bust. But in fact, it's the fact that generations next to one another have most in common with one another, but there does appear to be this definite sort of trajectory. And I'm not going to call it progress because I'm not sure that it is. And so what Twenge started to say is that history is not just a series of events, as sometimes we characterize it, but perhaps more profoundly, it's also the ebb and flow of culture and all that entails, be it technology, attitudes, beliefs, behavioral norms, diversity, prejudice, time use, education, family size, divorce. And the most important of all of these, and the one which he says has the most profound effect on our culture now, is the technologies that we have. So she's moved away from this classical theory of generational change as being based around major events to one of generational change being caused by cultural change and largely driven by technology. Let's just listen to a little bit of what she says directly. She acknowledges that major events can certainly shape a generation's worldview. just those who lived through the Great Depression, for example, were often frugal for the rest of their lives. However, this view of generations as shaped by cycles of events misses the rest of cultural change, all the ways in which life today is so different from life 20 years ago, 50 years ago, or 100 years ago. So she says, 100 years ago, household tasks like laundry and cooking took so much time and effort that much of the population could do little else. As recently as the 1990s, publicly sharing an opinion on politics meant physically attending a protest or writing a letter to the editor and hoping it got printed. It now involves just a few keystrokes on a smartphone to create a post on social media. And then she says, in much of the US in the mid-20th century, whites accepted racial segregation as normal, while today it is considered morally repugnant. The average woman born in 1930 ended her education with high school, married at 20 and had two kids by 25, while the average woman born in 1990 went to college and was unmarried with no children at 25. And these cultural changes, she points out, were not caused solely by major historical events like economic boom or busts or wars or natural disasters, because firstly they're linear, moving in roughly the same direction year after year, rather than cycling in and out like recessions or pandemics. And so what is the root cause of these cultural changes? And she said it must be something that keeps progressing year after year and something with a big impact on day-to-day life. And she says the strongest candidate is technology. And she says technological change isn't just about stuff, it's about how we live, which influences how we think, feel, and behave. And then she gives some helpful examples, which is interesting. She starts with the technology as television, and then looks at what are the consequences of technology like television. While we get more immediate experience of events, we get exposure to other regions of the world and cultures. We see a decline of reading, and also as people are visually exposed to things that they don't have, and as advertising starts to drive television, we see a rise in materialism. And then you might look at the technology of home appliances like microwaves or washing machines or refrigerators. And these, the downstream consequences of these sort of white appliances, as they're sometimes called, well, there's the ability to live alone. You no longer need two people to run a household as once you did. You get far more women able to pursue careers. And despite the fact of how busy we all feel, in fact, we get an enormous increase in leisure time. People don't have to shop every day. People don't even have to cook every day. Or she says, like air conditioning. Well, air conditioning actually has the effect of causing population growth in different areas. Say, for example, in the US, people now live in greater numbers in the South and the West because the climate becomes inhabitable, but with the effect that fewer people socialize outside. And birth control. Well, birth control, as Humanae Vitae prophesied, leads to more premarital sex, lower birth rates, more marital infidelities, and also to more women pursuing careers. Computer technology, where you get an increase in skills and education necessary for many jobs, and often you get a rise in work productivity, although perhaps now you get a decline as people are so distracted that they actually can't get on with the work that they're supposed to do. Then with sort of internet news, what are the downstream consequences of that? Instant access to information, decline of newspapers, and ability to filter news to our preferences. And then finally, she cites social media, which gives you the ability to reach a large social network, a decline in face-to-face social interaction, and political polarization. And she sees also two other things which sort of are affected by the changes in culture brought about by modern technologies. And one of the most profound ones, she says, is individualism. a worldview that places far more sort of emphasis on the individual self. And if you think, you know, an obvious example of that is if you were to look at a photo album printed out from, say, somebody who was born in the 1930s, and think about how many photos do you think would have included, would have been just them by themselves, or them by themselves, taken by themselves. Whereas if you think of the sort of average photo of a 15-year-old now, how many of the photos that you find on their phone would be them with their friends versus how many would be them by themselves? The technologies that we have now both enable us to spend far more time alone and yet not feeling completely disconnected from the world, because you can be in your bedroom and be in contact with numerous different people all at the same time. But then they actually result in us being by ourselves far more, because we don't need to leave our rooms for contact with other people. And then that starts to affect the way that we project ourselves and the way that we understand ourselves. We understand ourselves fundamentally as an individual, whereas in earlier ages, people would have understood them far more by relation to belonging to a particular family or coming from a particular area. Listen to a little bit of music now, and then I will, in the time that remains, take you back to a little bit to the thought of Jonathan Haidt and why he has come up with the title of The Anxious Generation, drawing upon much of the research from Gene Twenge to describe our younger people now. And what is it about the effects of smartphones in particular, and so much time inside, that he says is causing an epidemic of mental illness and particularly anxiety. Let's listen now to Psalm 84, sung by the Fisher Folk, "How Lovely Is Your Dwelling Place." Hello, you are listening to Radio Maria, and this is Father Toby with the Friar Side. And we've been considering today the concept of generation change, of how generation change is driven by culture, and one of the biggest sort of shapers of our culture now is technology. And we began at the top of the program with Jonathan Haidt giving us a hypothetical example of sending children to grow up on Mars. And then if you read his book, The Anxious Generation, you'll see how he draws out how that would be thoroughly irresponsible, but that we've perhaps done something just as irresponsible in the unregulated way in which we have given our children exposure to social media, to the internet, and particularly to having smartphones with them at all time. And just in the last couple of minutes, I'm going to sort of comment on a few of the things which, as I read them, I thought, gosh, yes, that's so true, and also so sad. But just before we do that, somebody has very helpfully told me that apparently what I had said was either Gene Twenge or Twenge is in fact more like Twangy, which makes me think of Widow Twanky from Pantomimes as a child, but it's Gene Twangy is the correct pronunciation apparently. So thank you to the listener who let me know that. Now, Gene Twangy, now I'm thinking of Widow Twanky and smiling each time I say that, she divides sort of Western society into largely six generations. She goes, you've got the silents, who were born between 1925 and 1945, the boomers, 1946 and 1964, Generation X, born between 1965 to 1979, Millennials, which I'm right at the start of, 1980 to 1994, Generation Z, or which she sometimes calls iGen or Zoomers, born between 1995 to 2012, and then an as yet unnamed generation born after 2013, who she calls Polars. I haven't got far enough in the book to discover why she calls them Polars or why others call them Alphas. But I want to sort of just have us think in this final few minutes about what are some of the effects that have happened to Gen Z, and because of the changes in the technologies that Gen Z have grown up with, and why hate thinks that this has led them to be such an anxious generation. We'll in subsequent programs think a little bit more about what some of the other characteristics of other generations are. And this isn't supposed to be some sort of character assassination of people who belong to these generations. Rather, it's supposed to help us to identify the particular strengths they have, but also the particular difficulties that growing up as part of a particular generation can have. And so he says the oldest members of Gen Z began puberty around 2009, when several tech trends converged. You had the rapid spread of broadband in the 2000s, and then the arrival of the iPhone in 2007, which brought with it the new age of a hyper viralized social media. And then he said that this really sort of, you know, took effect in 2009 with the arrival of the like and retweet or share buttons that transformed the social dynamics of the online world. And that's so true. Just those few buttons massively changed the amount of time that people spent online, but also the way that they related. Because before 2009, social media was just really a useful way to keep up with your friends, but it didn't have all the instant and reverberating feedback functions it generated, much less of the toxicity we see today. Rather, you just looked at what others were doing and they looked at what you were doing. And whereas now it's all about sort of feedback loops. Then he says another trend began a few years later, and this one, he says, hit girls much harder than boys. The increased prevalence of posting images of oneself after smartphones added front-facing cameras. And then Facebook acquired Instagram, which massively boosted its popularity. And this greatly expanded the number of adolescents posting carefully curated photos and videos of their lives for their peers and strangers, not just to see, but crucially to judge. And so he says Gen Z became the first generation in history to go through puberty with a portal in their pockets that called them away from the people nearby and into an alternative universe that was exciting, addictive, unstable, and, Haight says, unsuitable for children and adolescents. Succeeding socially in this online universe required them to devote a large part of their consciousness, all the time, to managing what became their online brand. And this was now necessary to gain acceptance from peers, which, as we all know, like, you know, being part of the in-group is like the oxygen of adolescence, to avoid online shaming, to avoid being put outside of the group, which is the nightmare of adolescence. And so he says Gen Z teens got sucked into spending many hours of each day scrolling through the shiny happy posts of friends, acquaintances, and distant influences. They watched increasing quantities of user-generated videos and streamed entertainment offered to them by autoplay and algorithms that were designed to keep them online as long as possible. And they spent far less time playing with, talking to, touching, or even making eye contact with their friends and families, thereby reducing their participation in embodied social behaviors that are essential for successful human development. And it's that last point, which he develops later in the book, the idea that we've gone from a play-based childhood to a phone-based childhood, which I think is so devastating and so sad and so important to recognize, because as I hadn't thought about, I just thought, well, play is like really good fun. And actually the children look much happier when they're playing than when they're on a phone. But he also points out how important play is for developing the resources to be able to thrive as an adult. And in play, we experience far more sort of obstacles, far more setbacks, far more hiccups. We have to negotiate far more, say, for the use of the object on the playground or the space that we're sharing with other people. Whereas online life has so much less friction. Everything goes so much more smoothly. And if our expectation of life is that it should be frictionless and smooth, well, then we become very anxious and very frustrated when we encounter the reality of day-to-day life as an adult, which is neither of those things. So I hope that's been interesting. My plan is next Wednesday, there won't be a Friarside from me, but the Wednesday afterwards to pick up some more of these themes and to look a little bit more of the thought of, I think, these two really, really important thinkers. And I think it's quite important that neither of them, so far as I'm aware, are sort of Christian, or at least they're not sort of, you know, card-carrying Christians making arguments from religious faith. But I think they have really important things to say to us as persons who are concerned with our own spirituality and with that of the children who we know or who are entrusted to us. So let's close with a prayer and bring all those people who suffer from anxiety, particularly in enormous numbers of young people, now before God in our prayers, as we close by saying, glory be to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
You've been listening to a podcast from Radio Maria. If you enjoy these programs, please consider becoming one of our monthly donors. All you need to do is visit www.radiomariaengland.uk and click on the Support Us tab for various options. We rely entirely on donations, so thank you to all our listeners for their generous support.